Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
McCormick and Richard Tauber are singing by the bed. There's a glass of punch below your feet and an angel at your head. There's devils on each side of you with bottles in their hand. You need one more drop of poison and you'll dream of foreign land.
Right there.
Oh, you went right here?
Yeah.
Fine, I can do that.
Yeah. So I'm noticing you still have the dulcet tones of the North. I was wondering what accent you were going to possess.
Well,
so,
you know that guy from, we watch it every year, that film, and it's got Keira Knightley in it. It's got...
Love Actually. There you go. Christmas classic.
Yeah, it is. We watch it every year. Well, once we gave over with It's a Wonderful Life, we moved to... you've just told me what the name of the damn thing is.
So these email questions are still going around in your head.
No,
Love Actually.
Love Actually, yeah. So the guy that goes to go and basically get bonked in Milwaukee, is it?
Yeah.
Then it's kind of like me. Like, I went to America not to get bonked or anything. I went to America
to get married.
To get married.
Far more honourable.
So, but that scene in the pub, in the bar, when they get him to say the word bottle and everything.
Yeah.
You know, like that, I think that's
probably
why. Oh my
God, you say
why.
Bin, not trash can? Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, that kind of thing. So my kids just laugh out loud when they hear me say, when a waiter or waitress doesn't understand that I want some water, then I have to go say, I'd like some water.
Some water.
And and they just fall about laughing.
Isn't it funny that certain accents just never disappear? And I think the more north you go, the more you're likely to keep it. Like, I've got friends who have parents from Glasgow, and they've lived in Birmingham, where I'm from, for 40 years, and they're still as Glaswegian as Rabsy Nesbitt. Like, it just does not go.
As I was saying, that I think it serves a purpose for me to keep my Manchester accent there. Although Danielle, my wife, will say that that my accent was stronger when she first met me, and it has weakened a little bit. But I mean, geez, if you can hear what it sounds like in my head, it feels like I'm putting it on.
Well, I guess it's at the point now you're in where when you're in America, people are like, oh my God, you sound so British, so northern. When you come back home, they're like, you've lost it. It's softened.
Yeah, no, so you can't really win.
No.
But you do get a reward for having a regional accent in the United States because they just adore listening to it.
I'll bet.
And on the phone, particularly if like something's gone wrong with the internet or something, or the television or whatever, if you ring them up with an accent like this, they will fall over backwards to help you out with what your problem is.
It's a good icebreaker, like right now. Well, the reason I ask is because my dad is from basically the same area, like sort of Worsley,
that kind
of part of town is where he grew up. And he, at 16, just got out of there and he joined the army. I mean, I think he came from quite a fractured home environment, and so that's why he wanted to get out. But I'm presuming you did a similar sort of thing in that once you hit a certain age, you were straight to London, right?
Well, yeah, but I was of the privileged sort of upper middle class family where my grandfather sent his children, my father and my aunts and uncle, to a boarding school in Yorkshire, actually, a Quaker boarding school. So in what became quickly a family tradition, then I was sent to boarding school along with my two brothers and a cousin actually went as well.
How was it?
It was all right. It was a bit grim to begin with. But then, as I was writing in this email interview today, that a lot of the songs come from, well, not a lot, some of the songs, one of them particularly comes from that period where although it's in the West Yorkshire coalfields near Featherstone and near Wakefield and Pontefract, nonetheless, it was still out in the fields. And that's where my first love relationship happened, was out in nature. Do you know what I mean? It's just like D.H. Lawrence something.
Yeah.
You know, just so the valleys, the vales and hills and fields are all infused with that kind of romanticism for me. So
because of a romantic experience that you had?
In my last couple of years at school, and we're still friends now. She came to visit in last year in Los Angeles, and there's always a little sort of frisson sort of thing with her. But and then I get to write a song about it, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that nature and then music as well, because I used to post myself in the music wing at school. At the time when my love object was going on her way to the house that the girls used to live in,
sleep in.
Yeah. And I'd open the window a crack, and then I would play like music.
Amazing.
So
that's Romeo and Juliet, right?
So
there.
That she would hear it on her way going down to the girls' house.
So were you always interested in music? And I guess because you're quite a multi-instrumentalist, were you always adept to be able to just pick up certain instruments and figure them out fairly easily?
There was a band at school, but didn't really have a name. There was a guitar player who came back. Well, there was a guitar player and a drummer. But the object was, the plan was to go away on holiday over the summer and come back having earned enough money from your job, holiday, summer job, to buy an instrument and come back to school the following term with your instrument. So I was the bass player for that, but I never picked up a bass. And I went through Bells, Bells of Surbiton. They had a mail order thing. There was a bass there for 19 quid. And I was going to buy that working in a hardware store close by. And my dad said, no, that's specialising straight away. What you really need to do is learn how to play the guitar. So for my birthday, my parents gave me... Well, I shouldn't complain because it was great, you know, because I became a guitarist because of this rather than a bass player. So they were kind of right, but it fucked the band up. Because
they already had a guitarist.
It was just a guitar. They had a guitarist, and they already had a drummer. And then I just came with this kind of Segovia-type classical guitar, and I couldn't really contribute. There was no amplification or anything. So I used to sit in the corner and just strum away, keeping up with them. They couldn't hear me. I could hear everything that they did.
Is that the birth of the folk roots then, is it, right?
Well,
there?
Yeah, because kind of. But
necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, basically. And I learned how to do the rhythm guitar playing shit from that, because I had to play it as loud as I possibly could. and nothing else but up and down sort of rhythm stuff. And then... And then I had piano lessons when I was at school as well, but then gave up with those because they just got boring, really. And then after that, funnily enough, in a school, they forbid me from going into the music wings at all to use the pianos. So whenever I played the piano, I was doing it against the sort of school regulations, and we'd get thrown out from time to time. So that became like a thing as well.
What, instilled in you a sense of rebellion? And
yeah, basically, yeah.
Distaste for authority.
Well, especially on that sort of intersection. Yeah, I mean, why would you prevent anybody from playing a musical instrument?
From being creative. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just a load of bollocks. So me and a friend actually who lives in Leeds, that he was doing the same thing as me, although he had never had the piano lessons. But we were playing the piano illegally at school. I mean, it's laughable. That we used to race to go find the music teachers. Own piano that they had in the meeting house, with it being a Quaker school, they had a meeting house, and he had like a Bösendorf or something. It's a fantastic piano, like walnut, it seemed like. It was beautiful. So me and Jonathan we were sort of in competition with one another to see who could get to this piano first after prep had finished.
Yeah, yeah.
To go and get to this piano then and see, you know, how long we could play before we got caught. It was great.
So what took you to London? What
just to get, I think, to get away from home, basically.
Yeah.
Because I'd have those sort of career meetings with parents where I'd just try and fend them off, where they'd say, well, how do you consider being an architect or a doctor? And I couldn't take any of them seriously at all. But wait a minute, that's before I got qualified and everything. I think, well, basically, I've screwed up all my exams and had to spend a year at home retaking them at a sixth form college. And then...
So by then you'd well and truly had enough, had you?
Yeah, it was a miserable year. I really did not like being at home, and I stuck out like a sore thumb, basically, at this sixth form college. Took me a long time to sort of re-socialise after 6 years of being at boarding school. I mean, it sounds weird to say, but it
almost institutionalises you in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
because it cuts you off from engagement with, you know, a cross section of society and.
Yeah, I guess it would. Well, yeah, or at least the whole thing was sort of inward facing a lot of the time, you know, and that's what made it a rich sort of experience. But at the same time, I didn't feel all that equipped to spend a year at a sixth form college. You know, I had hair down to my tits and the same clothes every day and was one of the few smokers that were there.
So basically, you're at college with a bunch of squares.
Well, no, they weren't squares at all. They were all right kids, but I wasn't all right. That's the thing. I just did not know how to fit in. It didn't start very well because my dad said to me that I had to go for an interview at the sixth form college, and my dad said, if you're going to an interview, you have to wear a suit. Look at me now.
Still like, rocking it.
I wear a suit every day. You know, like so.
Yeah.
Just do. So I went to this the interview for the sixth form college wearing the Sunday suit regulation thing that we used to have to wear at school. And then when I got accepted, which I wasn't ever likely not to be accepted to Eccles sixth form college, then on my first day there, I just wore what I usually wore, which is a green rugby shirt, a tatty old tweed jacket and some low loon pants. I had some blue loon pants. So I turn up then, and then in my first report, the head teacher said, "It's nice to see that James has made some adjustments to the way that he
his
wants
appearance."
To... Yeah, for God's sake!
Cheers, guys.
So,
bit of encouragement there,
a bit, and so I played music there as well with a phenomenally talented guitar player, and I really can't remember his name. I do hope that he had a career of some kind because he was so good at what he did. Nothing that I could come up with, like Steve Howe, kind of prog rock jazzy type stuff, and he could do anything,
right?
And I would just strum along again with him or play the piano a bit. And then when it came to having by the skin of my teeth passed the right number or amount of exams or with the right numbers attached to them, then I was accepted to Liverpool Polytechnic or Ealing Technical College. So I chose the one that was furthest away, simply. And so that's where I went. I played music all the way through there, but without getting in a band. And it wasn't really until I'd graduated from Ealing Tech with a humanities degree. Then I got a job at the London Chamber of Commerce, weirdly, for a bit. And then
what are you going to be doing there?
Just a research assistant,
right?
Because that's what I was good at, and I still am.
Do you apply that to your songwriting, that approach?
Yes, I do, actually. Yeah. It's fun to... So working with Mark Orrell from Dropkick Murphys, that he'll come up with like basically a fully finished sort of harmonic structure to something with a melodic thing going on too, and we'll have a bash together with Ted Hutt as well to sort of nail it down so that the parts all seem to lead from one to the next. Then I go off to my computer, basically. I'd like to say
your modern day library.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I just chase things down. And then the music sort of makes me think of something, and then I'll go and chase what that makes me think of down, and then that'll lead up to something else, and I'll just go down a rabbit hole. Then you find all sorts of different worlds out there and different ways of expressing certain things or uncertain things. And so then I kind of collect it all together and make it rhyme and scan, and that's basically
it's a very methodical approach. Yeah.
Yeah, in a sense,
from the lyric point of view, at least.
I don't know about methodical. There's a method, so there is. But then I don't mind being distracted by learning about something else that I didn't expect to learn about. So there's one of the songs.
So it's not fixed in stone. You'll kind of go wherever the momentum takes you.
No, so I would. So near us, there's in LA, I live near Koreatown. And there's HK Supermarket on Western Avenue, which we go to fairly regularly. And there's a florist outside. And there was this tune playing from the florists that kind of got into my head. So, the iPhone and with a lot of the songs, I tend to whistle them into the iPhone.
Yeah.
And I probably got it totally wrong. But that was fine. It was like a nice open pentatonic sort of melody. And then get together with Ted to begin with, and we knock about a few things chords wise, and then there's another tune comes up, then go off to write the lyrics, and then I find myself in Korean mythology and odd but positive quirky ways of expressing yourself about love and life and hope and expectation and whatnot. So that's enjoyable, where you get going into a place that you had no idea that you were going to find yourself in.
How did you meet Mark, first of all?
Through being on the road here in 2005 with Dropkick Murphys opening for the Pogues in Up and Down the Country. And it was Tim Brennan and Mark Orrell who were the most gregarious, I think, out of, not that they weren't unfriendly or anything, Dropkick Murphys, but those two guys would come and hang out in our dressing room a bit, and they were fun blokes. And then
was that the year you re-released Fairy Tale as well?
We re-release Fairy Tale every year. It's actually two. Well, like somebody does. Well, they try to get it. You know, there's always a campaign to try and make it number one.
Every Christmas,
and which is really adorable. And maybe it will one day. I kind of hope it doesn't.
Yeah, it's kind of mad that it hasn't. I think, was it two when it first came out? Did it get to number two?
Yeah. And I think the highest it's got since then is seven.
Right.
Might be wrong about that. But 2004, there was a push to try and get it. It was properly re-released,
yeah,
as I remember, by Warner's. And we did some TV stuff in and around that with Katie Melua.
Yes, I remember, on the Jonathan Ross show, right? Did you sing it live on that with her?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Oh, and Shane fell over. I don't know if he fell over on camera, did he?
I don't remember seeing that.
No, I don't remember if it was a sound check or... Because there's a... Right at the end, live, when Kirsty was alive, I'm going to say Kirsty McColl, just in case somebody listening wouldn't know who I was talking about. I just have to do that. That when Kirsty, at the end of the song, Shane and Kirsty would sing like, would dance like a, well, just a dance. It wasn't like anything like a waltz or anything.
Yeah,
just
like a river dance kind of thing.
Not river dance. You mean like bounding across the stage and doing all the high stepping stuff.
Yeah, none of that.
No. They just go around in a circle.
Right.
They were on top of a cake.
Like barroom kind of dancing.
Yeah, basically. Drunk barroom dancing.
Yeah.
But Kirsty had a way with balancing Shane so that he never fell over.
Right.
And he was a little
bit
more...
They had it dialed in, yeah.
Yeah, and he was a little bit more agile than in the second go-around. But we'd had several people who could pull it off with him. But Katie Melua was a tiny creature. And maybe she just didn't know how to keep him upright when he got dizzy.
Yeah.
Because they just go around in a circle. And then he fell over, I seem to remember he fell over a monitor wedge or something, and Katie Melua, I didn't know what to do. And why should she? You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Is this, you know, oh, yeah. Anyway, so it is some promotion for all that, but still it never got to number one.
How did you and Shane meet?
Oh, through a band called the Nipple Erectors back in 1980 that I was doing bands, auditions around London. I was living in Kingston at the time. And I saw an advert in the Melody Maker saying, you know, name band wants guitar player. So I rang up and I went up to Halligan's rehearsal rooms on Holloway Road. And that's when I first met him. And I didn't know what the band was that I was going into. And but he looked really familiar. Then I realised that he was the guy that had nearly had his ear bitten off by what's her name out of the Modettes sometime. And I forget where it would have been, Camden Palace or something. But that's what leapt him to sort of local London renown in any
right.
case.
Had he done anything to provoke that, or was she just crazy?
I think it was just bonkers. Yeah, I think the whole thing was bonkers. At that time.
It was a crazy time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I do think so. And Shane was in right in the middle of it.
It's funny because I think the Pogues are so synonymous, obviously, with Ireland and Irish culture.
Yeah.
But so much of London and that London punk scene is obviously intrinsically seeped into the attitude and the sound of the Pogues, isn't it?
Yeah, like, so it is. Like, yeah, like when people
London have as much a part of it as...
Well, yeah, because people mistake the Pogues to be an Irish band, or have done. It's not that we didn't discourage that with some of the stupid, you know, picture discs that we released, you know, with like, you know, wheelbarrow races or something, and the one of the singles was a shaped in the shape of a map of Ireland. I don't know if that's a collector's item or not. It needs going in the bin. Really.
Can you even play it? Is the question. When it's going round.
Well, it would go round because they made the
grooves would go inside.
So
was it King's Cross? Was that the sort of area where the band was?
Yeah, that's where it was, just south of King's Cross. Amongst at the time, it's changed now. At the time, it was, and it had a change then from when they were all Peabody Estates, which, as far as I understand, Peabody Estates are for the working class of the Victorian era that that Charles Dickens helped to set up. So it goes back as far as not set up. He helped to publicise that how poor the living conditions were, and do-gooders, philanthropists like Peabody, and he might have been an employer, I'm not really sure, built all these estates there. So we lived, when the Camden Council couldn't afford to keep them going as housing stock, then a charity took them over and they became basically legalised squats.
Right. So ideal for young, struggling artists.
No, no, indeed. Yeah, there were hot houses for all sorts of things. Yeah, there's so many artists come out of the Widbourne buildings, they were called. And so the first gig that we played was at the end of Shane's street, which is Cromer Street, just south of King's Cross. And we had our community too from Widbourne buildings, because everybody knew one another. They were all up to different things. So we filled out the Pindra Wakefield as it was then, but now it's the Water Rats.
Yeah, yeah. So that was like, I guess, like a famous music hall live venue, right?
It had
that kind of history. Because didn't Bob Dylan do his first UK show in there as well?
Who's?
Bob Dylan.
I don't know, but I do know.
Is it the venue that's now called the Water Rats?
It's called Water
Rats. Yeah, I think Dylan did his first ever UK
and
show
so
in there.
And so did Ewan McCall. Well, I don't know about his first one, but Ewan McCall used to play there. So
right.
It used to be a folk club first when it was the Pindra Wakefield. And then when we'd left, it became the Water Rats. And actually my girlfriend at the time, Debsey Wykes, who was in a group called Dolly Mixture, her dad used to play piano for the music hall there as well. So that pub's been
It's still going,
life.
Isn't it? Still,
I think
yeah.
it is.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
a long time since I've been there.
Yeah,
we
I
used to go and
is.
Collect our wages from there. I'd go down to the bank. The Royal Scot RSB in King's Cross, and then come up on my bicycle. take me back into the pub and then distribute the wages that such as they were.
A pound each or something.
Well, no, it was like 150 quid a week.
Really?
That we were on, even then, in 83, 84.
Well, how many gigs a week were you doing? Every night or
a
couple of times?
No, not a lot. We were gigging a lot around then.
Was the scene itself quite small then? Because it seemed like all the bands seemed to know each other. Like, didn't Paul Weller produce a Nips demo or something like that?
He was going to, but then that fell through. Don't really know why. So that Shan Bradley, she wasn't called Shan Bradley at the time. Shan Hasler, because we had two managers, a guy called Howard Cohen and a guy called John Hasler, who used to play drums in one of the early setups of Madness.
Right.
And John Hasler was the other manager, and he was married to Shan, the Nips bass player, with whom Shane was already in love with and had been barred from the wedding of these two, but they were still in a band together. It must have been really painful for Shane to find himself in, put himself in the middle of that kind of...
unrequited love triangle, yeah.
Yes, basically. And I don't think he's ever not loved Shan ever since. He's just one of those romantic guys, so he is.
Yeah.
And how we got onto that, I've no idea. You'll have to remind me where we...
Just talking about the scene being quite, small at that time. A lot of musicians familiar with each other, a lot of crossover, a lot of work going on.
Yeah, so Shan was she was in the Nips too.
Yeah.
And then Weller was going to produce on Respond label, an EP or something. But then Shan was pregnant with John Hasler and her first kid. So I said, "Well, I'll play the bass since I started out saying, started our life as a bass player." Well, no, I wasn't a bass player at all. But I figured I could do it.
So that's how you wound up in that band, was it?
No, I wound up in the band from an audition.
Right.
That was in the August of 1980, and then we opened for The Jam and did gigs here and there around London.
Were they fierce back then? Were they tight?
The Jam?
Yeah.
They were the best group ever. I know The Clash were the best for me. If it's a competition, no, but The Jam had something that The Clash didn't have, and vice versa. But there was something honest and straightforward about both bands, really. But I loved the way that Paul Weller delivered his lines and words and the performance that all three of them put on. And they were nice guys. Paul a little bit intense, but you know, why not? I didn't mind that intensity. I did come across him when I'd written my book a few years ago, and he don't give anything away at all. And he said, "Hi, Paul, how are you?" And he goes, "That's all you get." funny guy. Liked him.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because he's got so much to say in his music.
Yeah,
and there's so much passion and anger and intelligence there.
Yeah,
and then on a social kind of playing field, it's like, he's not giving anything up.
No, he's not. No, he's not. But he was hanging out with people. He was hanging out with people.
Cards close to the chest kind of guy, isn't he?
Maybe a bit. But he had such passion for Shane's work and his lyrics and songs and everything. It's a shame that didn't sort of play out. So then Shan rang me up and said, "No, you're not playing the bass and you're out with the band in any case." So I just carried on doing shit. Then thought, no, I'm going to write a book now. So I tried to write a book, and I was I had a sign on my wall at this in my charity housing, £4 a week, one bedroom, one living room flat. It was amazing on Mornington Crescent. I had a note on the bedroom wall that just said "get up." So whenever I looked at it, after sleeping, of course, then I'd get up and then I'd go and write for the day. And then a year and a half into doing that and finishing nothing, Jem Finer from the Pogues, the banjo player, he knocked on my door and said, and he had a laundry bag with him with an accordion in it. He said, "Shane wants you to learn this." So I said, "Okay, how long have I got?" "Well, we've got a gig in, I thought he said 5 days. I think it was longer than that. I think it might have been 10 days.
Right.
I think the first rehearsal was five days.
It's days, though. It's not
it's
weeks.
It's days. No, indeed. Yeah. It was days. A matter of, So I said, I'll have a go. So I did. I learnt a few hymns on it first. And then went down to the first rehearsal at Shane's place on Cromer Street with Jem, which was Jem, Shane and me. And we played a number of songs, some of which ended up on the second record of the Pogues, and some of them on the first, but it was mostly Rum, Sodom and the Lash that they all came from. Like The Old Main Drag was on this tape that Shane gave me to learn from, and Streams of Whiskey, but that was on the first record. It's like across the two of them.
Yeah.
So
it was
I'm
just the
home.
Three of you at this point. So banjo.
No, in that room, yeah. But Spider and Shane had already been doing stuff.
Okay, so Spider's in the mix as well. Yeah, so it's kind of a four piece to start out.
I guess John Hasler might have been involved as well that early because we needed a drummer, and I don't know why John Hasler should have been made the drummer. Not a clue. Because the way that Shane and Shan and John Hasler had that sort of weird sort of fucked up. It's not fucked up. John loved Shan. Shan loved Shane, and John Shane loved Shan. Could put up with John basically, and that's how that works.
Yeah.
But he was the drummer, so that was just like a given. And then Shane had met Cot O'Riordan, who I think was working in a bar at the time. And I think basically he just fancied her and said, all right, well, do you want to play bass in my band? So we had to teach her how to play.
So it's a proper punk rock band, the way it's brought
together. Yeah, I guess,
except
we're a bit older starting out. I mean, I was 28 this time. Cot was like all of 16 or something. Spider a bit younger, not than 16, but he was younger than me. And then Cot basically took it on herself to fire John Hasler because he was crap at playing the drums. I don't think he was all that crap because he didn't have to do much.
Yeah.
And then we spent a bit of time in the wilds trying to figure out how we could get somebody to play the drums the way that we wanted them to play drums. And then Andrew Rankin, who lived on the estate as well, finally said, yes, okay, I'll play drums for you then. And that's how the initial six of us, was it six to start off with? Started off. Yeah.
And did you go out and do some shows with The Clash? And then is that where the
we did
the Stiff Label interest and then the first record?
No, the Stiff Label interest came. And then Elvis Costello took us on tour in 1984. So we went up and down the country, then to Ireland, and that's when basically he fell in love with Cot, the bass player.
Yeah. Did that cause friction in the group? Because he obviously produced Rum, Sodomy and the Lash. And
that's right. No, there was no friction. There was a bit of sort of toe-curling kind of episodes when he was teaching her how to play the bass for a particular song, and it just got a little bit too sort of physically intimate.
Yeah.
So we all
and there's five of you set, like,
like looking through the window. It's like, oh, give it all over. Find a room. Then what?
What's your memory of making Rum, Sodomy and the Lash? It's such an amazing album.
Oh, it's a great record.
I mean, because that first one, I guess, was sort of half and half, wasn't it? Half traditionals, kind of shanties and folk stuff, and then a few originals. But then I guess the Rum, Sodomy and the Lash album was really where Shane's songwriting began.
No, it just came out. It
flourished.
It blossomed. And I think the song for me, does it start with, I can only remember the, ding, 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 ding. The Sick Bed of Cú Chulainn.
Yeah.
I think it starts with that.
Yeah.
Which is such a fantastic song to start off with the whole tableau I can't remember the singers, Richard Tauber and McCormack by the guy's bed.
Yeah.
I mean, just it looks amazing. That does. It's so fabulous. But the recording of it, Yeah, it was good. There were some challenges that Elvis put me through as a musician, but they were fine to overcome in the end, which I think I did. And then there's someone coming in, but that's all right.
That's
probably
all good. They know not to come in here.
Where did you put my bottle of water, by the way?
Right over there.
Can I just put that down?
Of course you can, mate. Yeah. Down. It's weird because Elvis Costello did the Specials album as well, didn't he? And I guess
that's right.
What the Specials were doing was, I guess they were doing to Scar what you guys were doing with Celtic Folk, just injecting a bit of new punk influenced fresh energy into it, isn't it?
Yeah, with stories of the underprivileged and the beaten down. Yeah. I guess that's true. In fact we used to go off on Nips outings with Howard Cohen, the manager, and Shane and me out to go and see the Specials play at Cambridge or something. We just we'd say let the trains take the strain, which was the motto at the time. We just bunk the fare and go up to Cambridge and go and see
the
Specials.
Strain, I love it.
Yeah. So that was kind of fun.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What an exciting time. Mm. What an exciting time.
And an exciting time now, after all that, to go through a 9-year first stint with the Pogues and make 7 records, which I don't know, I changed something for some people. The kind of emails and the feedback that I get from fans and stuff is that it's kind of locked into people's hearts, the kind of music that we did.
Well, it's timeless, isn't it? And not only that, I think when you reformed, the live shows took on a whole new energy and momentum, didn't they? Mm. And it became like the annual Christmas night out for families, I think. And it really instilled a generational love and affinity to the band.
Well, I always joked that we basically doubled our audience in the interim.
Yeah, yeah.
We let them have kids.
Yeah,
so that they could
much.
Bring their kids to the actual shows.
Yeah.
And for me, my family as well. It was sometimes the only opportunity that I could see my family in Manchester. I'd go and play the Manchester Evening News Arena. It described a bell curve, the actual reunion phase. I mean, we started off slow and then we peaked around maybe 2005, 6 or 7, and then went described the other side of the bell curve on the other side, which is fine because you can't expect to keep going up and up and up. And when there's no, you're not recording anything.
It's peaks and troughs, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was mostly just on the goodwill and the being locked into people's hearts the way that we were, that we were able to come back and not bring any product with us the second time around.
Was that a conscious choice? with everyone?
No, because we tried to sit together. I don't think I would have been any use in this because I always sort of got under Shane's nails a lot of the time because I'm opinionated and judgmental, and which I am,
yeah.
And I was.
Well, at least you're aware and honest about that with yourself.
Yeah, it took me a while.
Yeah,
it just doesn't happen. So it was felt best, politic, that I should stay away from the discussions to see if we could get Shane. No, I'll see if we could get Shane, to see what Shane had or what he'd been doing. And it got as far as Spider's flat in Finsbury Park over a cup of tea with Jem and Spider and Shane, where they were all... The plan was to bring up... Well, we were thinking, shall we see if we can... What songs we all have and if we can put something together and perhaps go into the studio. That was... That question was framed, but it never actually came out. They just had a cup of tea at Spider's... flat, and then they all went home. So that's as close as it got as far as my understanding is.
It is interesting though, because when a lot of bands from your, you know, the Pogues era reform and then do put out new music, there is often that, because you're still in the, not the confines, but you're dealing with a legacy that's, you know, very special. And when a lot of these groups reform and make new music, and then they get to go play them live, and they say, oh, we're going to play a new song next, and there is often that moment in the room where everyone goes, oh, I'm going to go to the bar. Do you know what I mean? Because a lot of the time when you're dealing with a legacy that's so rich, often you can't ever really top that classic material. And so I think it's often best to just start a new group, like you've obviously done now, under new forms with new members. And if you still want to write new music, because I still wanted to do stuff,
and that's why, you know, leaving the band the first time round. I mean, Shane. We left Shane ourselves.
Was Shane fired, or did he leave his own accord?
No, I guess we fired him. Yeah. Would be the word. I tried to use the word let go, but we fired him. We brought him to a hotel room and said, we can't do this anymore. And then he just said, what took you so long?
Basically. Really? That was his response.
Yeah.
Was his heart just not in it, or is he just out of control with other things?
A bit of both, I would say. And he was struggling with the whole pressure of having to do what he had to do every night. All I had to do was throw an accordion around and show off and play all the notes right. That's all I had to do. I didn't have to stand in front, you know, under the lights, bearing my soul every night, basically. Yeah. Now, that seems to imply that if I'm the front singing guy in the Walker Roaders, that I'm bearing my soul every night. That's my choice, I think, to... Oh, I don't know. I think Shane had no choice, but...
He had to live it, right? He had
I think so. I'm glad you put it that way, because I'm shallower than Shane is, so I know...
Well, you're perhaps telling stories from a narrative point of view. Whereas he's living his stories, isn't he?
Even though a lot of the stories that he would sing about were, there were still just stories where he'd put, I guess, you know, so the furore about, you know, whether you can say scumbag, maggot, cheap, lousy faggot in Fairy Tale of New York. The thing is that he's telling a story.
And that's the language that
his characters
would have undoubtedly used.
Yeah. Yeah. That implies this is that one remove between the subject matter and the person who's delivering it.
Yeah. But he still lived with and felt that pain and that's the joy and the full emotional spectrum.
And also the awkwardness of being the centre of attention in a room sometimes with 10,000 people in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was rare that it was 10,000 people, but sometimes it was.
And no, touring, you know, when you're on the road, if you do have a weakness or a liking for alcohol and other things, when you're on the road and it's around you all the time, it takes its toll, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's hard. You just get tired anyway.
Yeah.
And drinking just makes you even tireder.
Yeah.
And you start the day on a deficit. Then it just goes downhill from there, and then
you think, well, if I'm hungover now, I've got a drink to get through it, and then
I guess it spirals
out of control that way, doesn't it?
So basically, I stayed with the Pogues for another 2 years with Spider singing the songs.
Didn't Joe Strummer sing for us?
That's right. No, in 91. Yeah, so he did.
How was that?
That was
for
fun.
You as a big fan of the Clash, working with Joe. That
it was huge.
Did he produce the last album you did with him? Yeah. So he produced that record, and then you kind of were like, "Well, we need a singer. You're here."
Well, it was he wasn't here. He was in LA at the time.
Right.
And so me and my wife, Danielle, got in touch with him, and got in touch with Jem and everybody else first.
Yeah.
To say Joel's in town here, and we were going to go and have a drink with him. What do you think to the idea of our asking him if he wanted to work with us for a bit? So me and Danielle met him. Oh, I can see the bar right now. Not that it's got, you know, like the plaque on it saying Joe Strummer said he would go and work with the Pogues in this bar or anything, but I can see the place. It's on Highland Avenue. We met up with him there. So we asked him, and he says, yeah, I'll give it a go. So we gave it a go for a year, basically, and it was a joy to play with him. Really, really fantastic.
Were him and Shane friends, and were they mutual admirers of each other? And was it like a very easy
fit?
I guess they were friends.
I don't know. Socially, I don't know if they got together. I really wouldn't know about that. They probably did. But with Shane gone in the August of 1991, and then Joe pretty much straight in after that, it seems like to me, my experience of it was a clean cut between Shane and Joe. And then Joe did a year with us.
He did a whole year, did he? Wow.
Yeah, maybe not.
There's a decent amount of shows in that time.
A decent
though,
amount
there?
Of shows. Yeah. I went to Canada and America and Europe, all over the place. So we did the full round.
That would have been a special tour to see.
Yeah, it was great. Really, really, such a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Because what
did he bring to the table on the live side of things?
He gave
because it would have been obviously similar enough, but also very different, I imagine, as a performer, as a singer.
Yeah, no, I don't know how we did it, but we didn't have to change key or anything. I don't know how that is, but he his work ethic was like second to none. The reason we went to him first was because we'd asked him to come and play substitute Philip Chevron because he was sick with a duodenal ulcer. This is so funny. Because my first experience of getting to know Phil Chevron was on a ferry going from Hamburg to Helsinki. And we stayed up all night talking and basically finished a bottle of schnapps. The next morning, during the night, he had some sort of duodenal attack. And they went round, Andrew and Spider, I think, went round the ship looking for the ship's doctor to look after Philip. Philip went straight into hospital as soon as we got to Helsinki. Managed to do some gigs a bit later in Stockholm and stuff. But then once we finished the Scandinavian tour, he went to go and see a specialist. And the specialist says, you've got an ulcer, you've got to stay home. So
from one night of drinking with you.
So it's kind of. I saw like a spider still says, it's all your fault. So we'd met Joe on the film with Alex Cox in 1986. Well, this is going back years.
So you'd gone down there as well to Spain and you'd been involved with
that. That's right. Yeah, indeed. So we got friendly with him then. And so I don't know whose idea it was to bring him on to play guitar, deputising for Philip. But Joe had all the chords written out for all the songs in the set. So they would go round the side of the body of an acoustic guitar. So we'd start with the neck up to read the chords of the first songs. And by the time he'd finished, the neck was down and he was looking at the back end of the guitar for the rest of the chords, for the encores. And every damn chord was on there. Wow. And it fitted perfectly.
Yeah.
It's so cool to see that.
That'd been a piece of art.
Yeah, I know. Well, I wish I knew where that was.
Yeah, right. No,
really, really great. On stage, when he was the front man, he was a great ringmaster type person.
Yeah.
If he saw once he saw something going on in the crowd, and he just put his guitar down, and just jumped into the crowd to sort it out. And we just stood there like idiots watching him in there, in the crowd, trying to forget what else, whatever it was, out. I never found out. And backstage, he came up to us and said, when any one of you, the members of the band, gets off the stage and goes into the crowd, everyone has to go and do it. So we felt really ashamed of ourselves for just gawping at Joe sorting it out.
You left him hanging.
Mm.
And then your decision to leave, were you just kind of creatively wanting to go in a new direction? Did you feel like the Pogues had played out? And
Kind of, sort of. Spider was difficult, became difficult to work with. He's now been, he's sober for many years now, and he's, it was a difficult time for him when he went sober, because I met up with him, I was at a party where you could just see how difficult it was for him to be out socially. But he got through all that, and now he's one of the funniest, on the money guys that you could come across.
So you're still close with him and
yeah,
all the
yeah.
other guys? Are you all generally still friends?
Yeah, generally. Yeah. I don't see Andrew quite so much. Daryl's not doing too well health-wise, but he's still popping along. Jem's working, doing art installations and whatnot, and music stuff.
It's ironic that Spider's sober, because a couple of years back, the Pogues released a whiskey.
That's right. No, indeed. Yeah.
I was on the, they did a bunch of shows all around the UK trying to find unsigned bands and just showcase the drink.
Were you on the panel?
Well, I was hosting all of the
nights. Oh, hell.
The nights.
All right.
Were you at one of those shows?
No,
then?
I wasn't. No. Spider came to one
of
them.
He was at them, yeah. So I was like, oh. But that's funny that
how funny.
I mean, he must be in a good place with his sobriety to be able to go out.
No,
and
he is so
promote
he's
a whiskey
so
and
strong. Him and his wife went through it together. Is what, and they're solid as rocks, both of them. So fantastic now.
What about yourself? Do you drink? Do you not?
Yeah,
drink?
No, I do drink.
Did you never have that kind of the same problem with it?
I've had episodes where it's been a little bit much. And then episodes where I'm fine. It's I went through the whole Pogues thing. I would say kind of fairly unscathed.
Yeah.
But it's been lately, as an older guy, that I don't have the tolerance that I used to think that I had. So I can come a cropper sometimes. So, and then I get help from the wife or a therapist or something like that to see what's at the bottom of it.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Generally speaking, yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm healthy. And I think it was playing the accordion for all those years. Swimming. I did a swimming throughout all that time as well. So I'm fairly fit.
And what about Shane?
Don't know about Shane. I mean, it's not fun to see him in a wheelchair, but I can see him in worse, like an iron lung or something, or whatever. But it's great to see his teeth all fixed up, and it's great to see him still working with people, it seems to me. I don't know very much about his life anymore, apart from what I see on Twitter or whatever, or the odd Daily Mirror something or other.
So you're not in touch?
No. Which is fine. It's just one of those things. I was close with him once, you know, back in 1980 and 81 and throughout the Pogues, I suppose, until towards the end of the Pogues, where we sort of drifted apart, which is kind of inevitable. Yeah, no, I had my time with Shane, and I don't regret it at all. And you know, I still love him. So, yeah.
Is a lot of that time in the book that you wrote? I really wish I'd read that book ahead of this chat, and I need to read it because...
Oh, please do, yeah.
What's it called? Is it just The Story of the Pogues?
No, it's called Here Comes Everybody, Story of the Pogues.
Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues.
Yeah, you should have a go. It's fun.
Could you share a choice anecdote from the book that... stands out as a a snapshot of the
there's a couple already. Well, there's not. I can't do the Eye of the Storm thing, but you know, the end of the first chapter ends with Shane saying, "What took you so long?" And basically, the rest of the book is about why it took us so long,
right,
to figure out how to deal with Shane. And
was he a fun drunk?
Yeah, he could be. But then after a while, I think the when it's, I suppose when I saw that it wasn't fun being around him, then I distanced myself.
Yeah.
And let other people have the, well, no, not let other people have the fun with him, but let other people look after him. I was a bit of a coward like that. But you have to do what you can to survive, basically. But we're not talking about what I'm doing now, though.
Well, we're going to get there, mate. Don't worry.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's the full life story. Don't you worry.
Fucking hell.
We're getting there. So I want to talk about the project we were mentioning. So you leave the Pogues, right?
You're
in LA. You're with your wife. Do you have a little bit of time off to start a family and kind of just be a guy and live?
I had some time off to be a dad. And then, so my daughter, the firstborn was born in February 1993, and I was still in the Pogues at that time. And I realised I didn't really want to be in a band. I'd rather be a dad for my new kid. So after talking with Danielle, the wife, I went to go and have breakfast when I came back to London. I was living in off near the Children's Hospital, Great Ormond Street, which is where Jem was sort of living around there as well. So me and Jem went to breakfast where I handed my notice in. And I always felt a bit weird about this, that the notice that I handed in was 6 months, as if to say, it's going to take you 6 months to find somebody as good as me.
Nothing like a bit of self-confidence there.
No, but then I was just trying to be fair. You know,
Not leave them in the lurch.
No, indeed. But it's sort of, as soon as you start to say things, I gave them 6 months notice, it does sound like bragging. And in the end, they
found someone in one, and you're like,
right at the last minute when I was all finished, and that was quite a splendid sort of night to go to. We played at what's that place in Kentish Town called that's changed its name? Is it called the Forum?
Now it's called the Forum.
The Town and Country back then. Well, so that was the last gig that I did, and Shane showed up for that, and so did Joe Strummer for it. It was a great night. My parents-in-law put me and Danielle, the wife, up in the Savoy Hotel, which was fantastic. And
nice.
Then I got on the plane the next day and emigrated, basically.
Clean break, fresh start. What a nice way to do it.
No, it was brilliant. And then...
How did you find the LA music community and music scene? Was it drastically different to the London one? Was it easy for you to integrate with players in that town? And
didn't bother for a while, except my wife was an actor.
Yep.
She was in La Bamba. She played Donna in La Bamba. I don't know if you
like the
you.
Richie Valens girlfriend character, basically.
That's right. Yeah. And so she was. I'd visited her out in Greeley, Colorado, on a set for a film that never saw the light of day. And one of the other actors on the production was Catherine Keener, who was played what's her face in Capote.
With Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we found out that Catherine and her husband, Dermot Mulroney, who's the sort of go-to marriage guy, or used to be, the love object in, you know, the marriage films with I can't think of the names, Julia Roberts and the red-haired woman who played Lucille Ball in something. Anyway. They were married and just lived on the block down from us. And Dermot had come out to Greeley, Colorado, was spent the afternoon in the bar just talking about music. He turns out he's a cellist from a family who plays cello, double bass, viola, violin, and something else in the string family. the Mulroneys.
So that's how you wind up with those two brothers.
That's right. And Kieran turned out to be a neighbour two blocks the other way. So me and Dermot and Kieran would start just mucking about in Dermot's garage. I'd bring the accordion down and then we'd do some singing, like old sort of country songs. They've got great voices, the pair of them. Mine's not so good. And then we'd play and sing these things just in Dermot's garage. It was it was great to do. And then a friend of mine from England, who used to be the guitar player for Julian Lennon back in the 1980s, co-songwriter with him, said, "Why don't you do some gigs if you're doing stuff, singing and making up songs and whatnot?" So we went to Molly Malone's, where Flogging Molly, you know, first did all their stuff. We were called the Cranky George Trio, or sometimes we were called the Mossback George Trio, because we were called that's much later, because in the middle of that, then the Low and Sweet Orchestra happens with Xander Schloss from Circle Jerks and Thelonious Monster and Mark from Thelonious Monster, and a couple of other guys, Tom Barter on bass and Will Hughes on drums. I met Xander at a indie film premiere and said, "What are you doing now?" So I said, "Oh, I'm just playing accordion and fiddle and cello in somebody's garage in our neighborhood."
Well, literally.
So Xander says, "How do you fancy? I've got a drums, bass, and guitar and a singer. Do you fancy trying to put the two of them together?" So we went down to Mar Vista, where Xander was living. And just sort of knocked a few things around. Xander doing most of the songwriting. In fact, Mike doing the other half, I guess. Country songs type of things, and Xander playing, you know, some really complicated, oftentimes complicated orchestral sounding type stuff. At least they were arranged that way. And then an Irish one thrown in, which was great because it sounded nothing like an Irish song that you'd hear anywhere else. And then we started playing out around LA, from the Alligator Lounge on the west side to Luna, I think it's called Luna Park, up on Santa Monica Boulevard, and places in between. We did Lollapalooza Festival one year, and then Interscope signed us up. I think probably, well, somebody had the theory that the reason why we got signed to Interscope was because there was Jimmy Iovine, and there was the heir to the Marshall Field company, which was where all the money came from. Ted Fields, that's right. And it was because Ted Fields could see the dollar signs, you know, like go up when, because Dermot Mulroney was in the room. If he had a band with Dermot Mulroney in it, they're going to make some money, not realizing that there's no way that Dermot's going to take time off his career to go out on the road, because they wanted us to go into a van and go away for 3 months. I didn't either, because my second child had just been born. Kieran went out for a bit with my replacement accordion player, a guy from Wisconsin who was called Thor or something, who had got a long golden locks. But we did some things. We opened for the Neville Brothers in San Francisco.
And you put out the record, right?
Goodbye. We put out the record, goodbye to all that. It was a good record. I thought it was a really great record. And I had fun with them. Xander was hard to work with, and I had some sleepless nights. But because he's intense. He knows what he wants. And then if he thinks that you've found out what he wants and you're going to change it a little bit, he'll change it even more. So you have to try and catch up with him. At least that was my theory. But I had fun working with those guys. I'm still in touch with them now, which is great. And it was out of the Low and Sweet Orchestra colour section, we called it. We called ourselves the colour, which was the accordion, cello and violin, Dermot, Kieran Mulroney and myself. That's where the Cranky George thing came from. And I'd met Brad Wood by that time. He was a parent at my kids' elementary school. producer from Chicago who used to run Idful Studios there. Lot of stories, a lot of experience recording. Moved to LA, can't remember when, with his wife. So their kids went to the same school that my kids went to. We had he has a studio in his backyard, like in the guest house sort of thing, where we started recording with Dermot and Kieran, myself and a drummer called Sebastian Visconti, whom the Mulroneys knew. Originally, the setup had been distributing the drum kit, the parts of the drum kit between everybody's feet.
Right.
So I got the snare drum, foot-operated snare drum. Brad, being the bass player, he had the foot-operated hatbox bass drum, which was an old hatbox that Danielle used to have on top of a suitcase with a bass drum attached to it. Kieran got the cowbell, and Dermot did the hi-hat. And it didn't hang together all that well. I really, really...
It's a bold concept.
Yeah, I thought the concept was really fantastic. Yeah. And if we'd practiced, maybe...
Yeah, you've got to be really in sync, haven't you, for something like that.
And I think Brad was too concerned about the quality of the actual rhythm track holding together. Then that's when we got Sebastian to come and play. Tried to make him play standing up the way that we did with Andrew Rankin and John Hasler with the Pogues at the beginning. But then he had to...
The Slim Jim Phantom style, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed, yeah. True, it's me thinking that, you know, the Pogues invented it, but no, it was Slim Jim.
I think it was Slim Jim, yeah. I think he definitely popularised it within that scene.
And a good player, nice guy too. I've come across him quite a bit in Los Angeles. He's always reaching out. Nice man.
It seems like a lot of people, whether they're coming from England or the East Coast, as soon as they get to LA, are like, I'm staying. Did you feel like that as soon as you got there? Did it feel like I can do this good music here, I can have a good life?
You know what? With moving to, for me, moving to LA, I think, if we can get personal for a minute.
Always.
That I've was too good here in the Pogues at setting myself up for the fall guy a bit. The accent didn't help, the premature baldness didn't help, the sticking to wearing suits all the time didn't help. I just became a bit of a caricature, I think. And so I got teased quite a bit in the group. And it was a relief to go to another country where you could just reinvent yourself, except you just reinvented the same thing, but the Americans seem to like it. Yeah. So that's meaningless.
Start, a clean slate.
Yeah, kind of, where people wanted to know about me rather than confirm what they thought they knew is basically it. I'm not blaming anybody.
That's just an American trait, isn't it, as a whole?
Yeah.
Like, British people are a lot more quick to put down and criticize. That's just a British tradition, I think. Whereas with America, I think they're a lot more inclined to celebrate, and they're just a bit more positive, aren't they? They don't have that same inbuilt cynicism that we as Brits have always had, I don't think.
Well, I guess, yeah, but then...
And in the music industry, that can only go so far before it starts to become, as you say, painful and...
Yeah, well, I think when you're certainly with people that you've been working with and lived with and known longer than, you know, after a while, more than my own family. So and as I say, I didn't do myself any particular favors with preventing setting myself up. So maybe it was just time, you know, that I'd. You know, a new kid, a young marriage, a new house in LA, like a bungalow, and then on off periods playing, you know, cello and violin and accordion with a couple of mates down the street. It seemed like it could be a good life.
Yeah.
As it turned out, and yeah, it was. To get another record deal. Really quite quickly after setting foot, and with some great musicians, and with a cool record company.
Yeah,
because it was very
cutting edge, wasn't it, at that time?
At that time, yeah. And I think it probably is now. I'm not really sure. I don't really keep up with that. And then, and as I say, to be a dad, and then a new kid comes. I did a bit of film music, but not a lot.
Did you ever write your book? Not the Pogues one, but yeah.
No, I'm doing that now, actually.
You're working on that as well?
Yeah.
Busy man, then.
Sorry, what?
Busy man.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, I could work harder, but one could always work harder. So the book, basically, I did write, which was the Pogues, you know, the Here Comes Everybody, which I'm awfully proud of. Hard to do. My God, it was hard to do. You know, it changed the dynamic, I think, within the Pogues band when I gave them all copies of it in 2010.
Right.
It caused a bit of a sort of a flurry of telephonic activity between Victoria Shane's wife and Spider and his wife. To the point that I thought, oh, fuck, I've really fucked this up, you know, relationships-wise. And it was difficult, you know, to go back on the road in Australia, particularly after the book was published, confront, but I didn't want to confront anybody. I think I'd done plenty of that with actually writing the book, because somebody backstage once in England said to me, that book, you've got balls of steel. And I suppose I had without thinking it, not that it's, you know, the definitive act of courage is to write the book about your friends, but it could be the stupidest thing that you
to
would
be
ever do.
Honest and candid and upfront about. Dynamics.
There's a high level of stupidity about it, and there's also a high level of balls of steel about it.
Makes for a good read, though, right? When you print, revealing and insightful.
Well, yeah, and it was fun to go out on doing book tours and things. My dad always said, "When are you going to contribute?" Well, this is before the Pogues and everything. And it felt like, well, here I am. I'm contributing something. When I was, you know, in Waterstones in Leeds or in, you know, I tried to actually do independent bookstores when I could, because those are a dying race. And
as are independent record shops, yeah.
Yeah, no. So in the States, I actually, every book tour place that I did was an independent bookstore. And I'm awfully proud of doing that. But there I was, you know, like talking to people and reading from my book and thinking, wow, Dad, look at me. I'm actually doing what you told me
to
do.
Doing it, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
What about this new project? Are you going to tour that?
Yes, I guess indeed. That's the plan. Without a doubt.
So we mentioned a couple of guys earlier.
Yeah.
Mark from Dropkicks.
Yeah.
Ted from Flogging Molly. And of course, Ted has produced so many bands within that scene. Obviously, Flogging Molly, Dropkick Murphys, Boston's.
Yeah.
I guess the big one that he did, which would have probably helped him out a lot in his career, was the Gaslight Anthem album.
That's right, yeah.
Sound.
Yeah.
Massive record.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And
Bouncing Souls.
Old Crow Medicine Show, for which he won the Grammy for.
Oh, right, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And you've obviously got other players in the mix as well. It's not just a three-piece band. There's the full lineup of
musicians. Yeah, with Brad playing bass and Kieran playing fiddle and... oh, who am I missing? There's always one, isn't there?
But yeah,
Brian Head, who plays with Richard Hodgson from Supertramp, and played with Dick Dale as well.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, all that.
He recently passed, didn't he?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Legend. So yeah, are you going to bring it over here as well as the States?
Yeah, I'd like to, yeah, for sure. There's plenty of scope. It's expensive.
Yeah.
Is the thing, and we just knew. But this the single "Will You Go, Lassie Go," and the new track that's just come out, Lord Randall's Bastard Son,
It's got that hard rain's going to fall.
That's same, right. Yeah, no, that was such fun to write. That was such fun to write.
Where have you been, my darling young, my blue-eyed son, is it?
That's my words. Well, where have you been, my darling young one is the blue-eyed son might be from Dylan as well. But Dylan took it from Lord Randall, the Scottish ballad. And so I've taken it from the Scottish ballad too, but sort of, I don't know, just turn the screws up
Taking it in a different direction.
Yeah.
Seems like poetry's always kind of been a key inspiration for you. One of the Pogue songs that you wrote was about a Rembo poem.
That's right.
It was
based on Bateau Ivre by Arthur.
So
Rambo,
are you an avid reader?
Yeah, I was. I'm still, yeah. Like poetry a lot. Did you listen to John Cooper Clarke on Desert Island Discs?
My mate texted me about 2 days ago and said I need to.
You do?
I love him.
Me too.
I think his taste in everything, movies, music, pop culture.
Except he just slightly disappointed me at the end with without a doubt, at the end, the one record I'm going to take is got to be Elvis. And I'm sorry, we're part company, me and Cooper Clarke. But everything else was so fantastic. Really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I've got to check it out.
Program, yeah.
I heard his luxury item as well was a ball of opium twice as big as his head.
Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant. Only John.
The only other person on Desert Island Discs, not the only, there's plenty of them, but Kathy Burke was another one, was really fantastic. So, sorry, we went off on a little thing.
It's all good. So, yeah, the possibility of coming over here an option.
Yeah.
It's got to figure out costs and finances,
figure out costs and
schedules.
Yeah, I'd like to bring the whole band over if I can get some funding for that. There's projects that I can do with a live band in the middle of it. If I can, if I got funding, it could also be a TV option as well, which would be kind of fun to do with the Canals, which I've been working on for a bit. I'm so hell-bent on putting a band on a narrow boat from Liverpool to Hull, and we'll have visitors every day to talk about music in Manchester, in Liverpool, Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, Leeds, Hull, to talk to musicians and about music from those particular places, but do the whole thing by narrow boat.
Amazing.
And you have the people come on. Like, I was thinking to take Billy Bragg through Yorkshire, through Castleford and everything, to go and have a look at what happened to the coal mines and what they've become now, where one of them has been returned to its natural state as much as it can be, and another one is the home to the longest real snow ski slope in Europe, and that's at Castleford. And it is one of the weirdest places you could ever go to visit. And that was on the Glass Horton Colliery site. I think it'd be interesting to take Billy around there.
Yeah.
And just
film
talk
it
about
all as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Then get back on the boat, play learn a song or something, and play a gig at the end of the day in a canal side pub. Just need the fucking funding is all I do. And then I've got Walker Orders to do it.
Amazing.
They're all into it. And end up where Ziggy Stardust came from in Hull. I think that's where Ziggy Stardust was born, because all those musicians are from Hull or just outside. I'm enthusiastic about it. Yeah,
love it. And the rest of the time you're over in the UK, you got anything exciting going on?
Yeah, I'm writing the book while I'm here.
Right.
And doing interviews like this every now and again, or whatever. But I'm trying to get my head down every morning. It's a novel about a family, basically. It sounds really boring, but it's got a bit of a
twist. Nothing more like inherently dramatic than family dynamics and relationships.
Yeah, no, yeah,
it's the big stuff.
Yeah, so it's hard, but I'm having fun doing that.
Lovely.
And it's great being in this country. I love it. I love it here. And what's one thing that somebody asked me about, you know, well, you know, your question sort of prompted this at the beginning about going to America, Los Angeles, to live. Yeah, with one qualification, I don't want to die there. I want to die here.
Home.
Yeah, I do. I don't. It wouldn't be right, I don't think, somehow.
Or don't die yet, James.
No,
right?
No, there's plenty to do. Yeah, there is.
Thanks for your time,
lovely
mate.
To talk to you. Yeah,
really
absolutely.
Enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, man.
Great. Fantastic.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.